Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Happy New Year. This feels like it might be a good one. And at the end of the program, I'm going to present an overview of what informs this program for the whole year, the array of guests that you'll be hearing. And it's all about the relational shift that we're living through right now. So if you're a new listener, this will orient you for the year ahead. And speaking of the year ahead, the reason I think it might be a good one is there's a momentum building in several different areas. And if that escaped you, take a look at an article by Sarah Van Gelder, editor of Yes Magazine, who's been on this program. The article is entitled, 10 Hopeful Things That Happened in 2013 to Get You Inspired for What's to Come. You can find this article on the nationofchange.com website, and it was posted on the last day of the old year. And, of course, there were a lot of other lists like that. I'm sure you got a lot of end-of-the-year fundraising letters last month. And they talked about the big challenges ahead and the particular programs that they're going to pursue. But they also reminded everyone of the successful conclusion of several efforts that took place last year. So there really is a movement. It doesn't feel as calcified as it did for several years. And among my own picks for greatly welcomed and long overdue events that happened last year were, first of all, the first one-day strike by the fast food workers for higher wages. That seemed to trigger not only other strikes by fast food workers in other cities, but trigger a national discussion, and it got many new laws put on the table, not quite passed everywhere yet, but laws to raise the minimum wage in various cities, states, and at the national level. And all of this was linked to a larger discussion of the shift of so much money that's gone on over the past 30 years to already well-off people, including the huge tax cuts and the Reagan and then the Bush II administration for the very wealthy, which, of course, left greatly reduced budgets for public education, public health campaigns, and programs to help families get on a strong, healthy footing. I mean, I'm glad this conversation is happening now and that these bills are being proposed, but it's maddening that it's taken so long, because it was in 1973 where the wages for working people started leveling off. And then certainly after 1980, there was just a war against labor after President Reagan got in. So this could have been noticed, I'm sure it was, by statisticians somewhere. You know, every 5 years, incrementally, I think there should have been alarms. Whoa, look what's happening, and what this means for most people in the culture. But it went on and on, so we'll see now if a grand correction, as they like to say in the market, a grand correction of social funding, being a responsible citizen, you pay taxes, and that gives our society what it needs, so that everybody has opportunity. The second thing that surprised me was, Pope Francis. Who'd have thunked it? I mean, I've been watching that situation as an old Catholic, and really, I would have thought this could never happen. There have been so many conservative bishops and cardinals put in place. This group is never going to vote for someone like a Pope Francis. But then it happened, which just goes to show you never know. And then the third one would be the bill that was finally introduced. I've been ranting on about this for a couple years, and there's finally an actual bill introduced in the House and the Senate entitled Strengthening the Social Security Act, which would gradually keep raising the cap on taxable income for the Social Security tax. Because we have a national flat tax for Social Security, and it's entirely undemocratic that everyone doesn't pay it on all their earned income. So this bill has been introduced jointly in the House of Representatives by Representative Linda Sanchez, Democrat of Southern California, and in the Senate by Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat from Iowa. If it's passed, it will make Social Security completely secure, and it will end the whole discussion, the 30 years of efforts by the Republicans to put the squeeze on the Social Security program. So my guest today is someone who has been involved in social change work for decades. And she decided last fall to take that courageous leap from talking about what needs to be done to running for office in order to change things. My guest today is Marianne Williamson. She's an internationally acclaimed author, lecturer, and activist. 6 of her 10 published books have been on the New York Times bestseller list. 4 of these have been number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list. In 1997, she published Healing the Soul of America, calling for a holistic perspective on America's political system. It offered an examination of our history and politics, and it suggested personal and political solutions for the renewal of our democracy. Marianne's other books include A Return to Love, The Age of Miracles, Everyday Grace, A Woman's Worth, Illuminata, The Gift of Change, The Law of Divine Compensation. In 1990, Marianne Williamson founded Project Angel Food, a Meals on Wheels program that serves homebound people with AIDS in the Los Angeles area. She also co-founded the Peace Alliance, promoting legislation to establish a United States Department of Peace. And she serves on the board of directors of Results Organization, working to end the worst ravages of hunger and poverty throughout the world. In November 2012, Marianne convened a conference in Los Angeles called Sister Giant, Women, Nonviolence, and Birthing a New American Politics, attended by almost 2,000 women representing all 50 states. And I was there, and it was a great gathering, I'll say. She has also been a guest on television programs such as Oprah, Larry King Live, Good Morning America, Charlie Rose, Piers Morgan. She was referred to in a 2006 Newsweek magazine poll as one of the 50 most influential baby boomers. And 10 weeks ago, she declared her candidacy as an independent running for Congress in California's 33rd Congressional District, which covers part of the Los Angeles area. Marianne Williamson, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Charlene. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I'd like to begin by sharing with the listeners something written in Time magazine recently by the political journalist Joe Klein. Quote, could Williamson be the harbinger of a wave of independent candidacies in 2014? Are people so sick of the two existing parties that they're ready to go shopping for something new? And then he quotes someone else, Peter Hart, who does surveys for NBC and the Wall Street Journal. Peter Hart says, quote, we're seeing this all over our polling. People are sick of the status quo. 60% believe that the entire Congress should be replaced. They're looking for alternatives, unquote. So, Marianne, what brought you to this decision to run for Congress?
Well, what brought me to the decision was a combination of two of the things that you just mentioned. One had to do with Sister Giant. You were there. You saw the amazing energy. And I found myself saying to women all over the country, you know, you really should run for office. You know, you really should run for office. Because I have realized, as so many of us have, that number one, we don't have anywhere near proportionate representation numbers-wise in Congress, and also that you can't transform a situation that you will not engage. There's just a limit to what we can do from the sidelines. There's a limit to what we can do with, you know, online petitions, that there is so much activism and so much interest in the things that you're talking about on this program, but we don't have enough candidacies presenting those issues as platforms. And we know why. We know what the lockout is, but we have to just forge ahead anyway. And the second thing had to do with what you then mentioned, which was the general disgust that people are feeling. I'm feeling it. I can't be quiet about it. You're feeling it. You can't be quiet about it. But probably most importantly, I think that there's enough of an interest. I think there's a critical mass of people. Occupy helped create it. The government shutdown helped create it. I just think people are like, there must be another way. People are finally ready to disenthrall themselves of the illusion that the political status quo can fix all this, particularly since the political status quo created all this.
That's right.
So I think that there, when I say this in a way that I have not felt, and I'm sure that you are experiencing some of this, Charlene, I have just felt in the last year or so that you feel less radical saying these things. You see more people nodding their heads.
Right.
Fewer people are in denial, and more people are ready to say, you know, it's true. And if there's going to be an interruption, if there's going to be a pattern interruption, it's going to be from the people ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, the calling that I felt inside myself was to run for office.
Mm-hmm. And I think I just saw in the paper this morning that the partisanship is so entrenched, people emotionally attached to it. They hate the stalemate. They hate what's going on in Congress. But they seem locked in. If they're just going to be the old answers again, we're not going to get any movement. And it seems like it really has to be fresh energy coming in from elsewhere in our society, which would be the independent candidates, the green candidates, and other candidates other than the big system politics. So,
well, also, as long as they're there in the way that they're there, they get to perpetuate the illusion that they are more polarized than ever. That's what everybody says. They're just more polarized than ever. No, the real little secret in America is not that they're more polarized than ever, but that they are more similar than ever.
Yeah.
Because
oh, yeah.
Their money comes from the same place.
That's right.
So I think independent or third party voices are more necessary and appreciated in a way, if done correctly, than ever.
Yeah, I think you're right. Things have shifted and people are really looking at this option as being a pragmatic way to get things moving and corrected and healthy again.
I think it's not only a pragmatic way. I think it's ultimately the only way.
Uh-huh.
Because I know for myself, if I had felt that a conversation about the things that I feel matter most, and all the things you were talking about, plus NSA spying, Trans-Pacific Partnership, National Defense Authorization Act, militarization of the police, child poverty, mass incarceration, if I thought that these things were going to be discussed either in my district or in many places around the country as the real meat and substance of the 2014 midterms, then I would not have run. But
yeah.
I think that we've got to, you know, crash through those ramparts.
Right.
Because on the other side of those ramparts is a political status quo that not only is resistant to the solutions, it's resistant to the conversation around the problem.
That's right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
If we're going to have that conversation within the electoral system, it's going to have to be because we ourselves are actually running candidates.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with that. I want to take a minute and explain to the listeners that the state in which you're running, California, has a somewhat unusual electoral system now as of a couple years ago. There will not be a lot of candidates on the fall midterm election ballot in California. Instead, there will be only two names for every office because they passed a law a couple years ago that they're just going to take the top two vote-getters from the spring primary, no matter what party or non-affiliation they're from, and put those two names on the fall ballot. So, that's one thing to know. It's a little different than what people might be thinking. And also, just where is this California 33rd Congressional District? It runs along the coast area of Los Angeles. If you know Los Angeles, I won't go into it too much. But from Malibu all the way down to Palos Verde, and then it goes inland. So that's where she's running. And you can look on... Sorry?
Well, I just wanted to say it goes quite a bit inland. I mean, it's all of
West L.A.
and Topanga and Calabasas, all the way Beverly Hills.
Brentwood. Yeah, I was looking on the map. Palisades, it's pretty big. but I was looking on your website as well, and if people want to get more information about her position on the issues, the website is MarianneForCongress.com. Marianne is MARIANNE for Congress.com. And on the website, you'll see under issues, she's highlighting, there are many more, but just to get a focus, the nine that she's highlighting there, democracy at risk, the economy, education, mass incarceration, our food supply, climate change, health care, social security, and war and peace. So we just have a little bit of time here to do a little sampling, but let's talk about the economy. I liked very much that statement you have on the website for your campaign saying the solution is not to redistribute wealth, but to redistribute opportunity.
Well, you know, just as blood has to circulate in a body in order for the body to be healthy, opportunity and access have to circulate in a society in order for the society to be healthy. People have to have enough access to education, they have to have enough access to political influence, and they have to have enough access to capital for us to be able to honestly say that we have, to the best of our ability, created a system where if someone works hard enough, they have a shot.
Right.
And what we've done, obviously, as you yourself articulate so well, is we have siphoned off the main portals of opportunity, the main portals to that give one access to the material riches of our country, and put them in the hands of a relative few. So it's not just that only the 1%, you know, that they get to control 38% of the wealth. It's worse than that. A small portion control most of the access to education because the educational costs are so high.
That's right.
They control access to opportunity that goes way beyond just cash.
Oh, yeah. And so I think, I'm sorry to say that the movement about the student debt crisis, which is a very important movement, they don't seem to make the political connection other than the fact that, yes, Bush put it in the hands of the banks so they could charge this preposterous profit level in the middle of it all there. But the reason tuition has gone up, the federal and other tax support to public universities got cut.
Exactly.
So their budgets were cut, and then the tuition started getting yanked up every year. So there's a real connection between why the tuition was even so high, let alone then why they had to get student loans from profit-making endeavors instead of just from the government for the straight amount of interest they were paying to borrow it.
And I think the larger conversation is not only, as you're saying, and so importantly, how it got this bad, but also why it is important that it get be made right.
That's
it
right.
Needs to be made right for the sake of democracy as well as for the sake of economic justice. You know,
yeah.
Our elite takes a very paternalistic attitude towards job creation, so that our politicians in both major political parties will say, when a young person in America gets out of school, we need to have a job waiting for them. Well, excuse me. If we had been giving that person from the time that they were a small child the kind of educational opportunity that I believe each of us are entitled to as citizens of the United States, then they would come out of school ready to create their own multi-million-dollar company. We should look at people coming out of school not as the new workers, but also as the new job creators.
Right. Well, we have a very different economy.
Which is why they're keeping such a small group of people able to get educated to begin with.
That's right. And also just the export of so many manufacturing jobs. I mean, that didn't drop out of heaven. You know,
absolutely.
That was engineered by both parties with the GATT and NAFTA, and now they're trying it, NAFTA on steroids, as they call the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. So, you know, it's all engineered. Oh, where the people with the money can make more profit by sacrificing the people who are making these products here. If instead the project globally had been build up regional economies and trade regionally, you know, we wouldn't be so adrift with this trade deficit and with the export of so many jobs. But anyway, I want to move just quickly. You say a lot more about the economy, but in education, it's just so clearly linked. You know, you make that connection of, and I think that linkage is so important because the right is saying, oh, we don't like wage redistribution. You're just taking money out of some people's pockets and putting it, you know, You have to understand as a citizen that we pay taxes. I pay taxes. They may go to building an elementary school or a highway in Alabama. I'll never see it. I don't care. It's something the country needs. They don't have that attitude of, you know, we're all in this. We pay our taxes in, and then there are these societal benefits that we need to be a healthy, thriving society. So I think you're making the link here with the educational proposals is very important.
Well, I think that there's a larger conversation. There's there's a larger philosophical conversation here about what democracy is.
Yeah.
I think that we have subconsciously recreated an aristocratic situation. And the whole point of an aristocracy is that aristocrats feel entitled. You know, many people talk
right.
about how the poor have an entitled attitude. Well, the real problem in America, if you look at the actual suck on our economy, is that there are a few very rich forces that have an entitled attitude.
That's
now,
for sure.
This, we repudiated aristocracy in 1776, and we need to repudiate an aristocratic system again. Obviously not with a revolution this time, but with an evolutionary impulse with real political heft, which is why supporting political candidacies, actual elections, and campaigns based on these ideas are so important. But the idea here is, what is democracy? Because a plutocracy, oligarchy, corporatocracy, whatever you want to call it, is not democracy. It is a different vision of how society should be organized. And a democracy goes back to the founding documents, the idea that each and every one of us, that there is an equality, and that the governance of the nation, and in order to have the governance of the nation put in the hands of the average citizen, then by definition you have to have the average citizen able to participate in the opportunities of the country. So this goes even deeper than somebody else getting theirs versus us getting ours. Each of us, I think, is a steward. Every generation is a steward of democracy. Every generation is a keeper of the story. And so this is more than economic unfairness to you or to me or to anyone. This is about the disintegration of democracy itself. That's why, even if you or I, you know, capitalism has been good to me, Charlene. I've written quite a few books, and they've done well. But whether these particular problems are at your doorstep yet or not, all of us will be diminished if democracy itself turns into the death spiral that it could so easily turn into. And I apologize for my cough, by the way.
No, absolutely. That is well put. And we're going to pause right here to take a break, so rest your throat. This is Charlene Spratnick on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Marianne Williamson. Her website for her congressional candidacy is marianneforcongress.com. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnick speaking with my guest, Marianne Williamson, candidate for Congress in California's 33rd Congressional District, and she's the author of a new book entitled A Year of Miracles. Now, I'd like you to think back for a minute to what happened and was widely reported on August 20th last year, when a 20-year-old white man named Michael Brandon Hill slipped into an elementary school in Decatur, Georgia, near Atlanta. He was armed with an AK-47-style assault rifle and 500 rounds of ammunition and, as he put it, nothing to live for. As soon as the man entered the school and fired one round into the floor, Antoinette Tuff, a clerk in the school's office, called 911. And then she calmly kept a conversation going with the gunman and later with the 911 dispatcher. He told her he was sorry for what he was about to do, but he had to do it. Antoinette Tuff, though, calmed him down and told him he didn't need to kill anybody. She told him she knew what it was like to feel what it feels like when things are just so bad that you can't go on. And she told him he wasn't alone in having these kinds of troubles. She told him that after her husband walked out on her after 33 years, leaving her alone to support her disabled son, it was so difficult. She even thought about committing suicide twice. She said, I know how this feels. We're all going through something in life. We all go through it. I'm sitting here with you, talking to you about it, she told him when he mumbled something about no one wanting to listen to him. And she was so present there for him. She persuaded the young man to surrender, and she said, we're not going to hate you, baby. It's a good thing you're giving up. No one's going to hate you. She even offered to act as his human shield, to walk outside the school with him so police wouldn't shoot. Antoinette Tuff told Michael Hill that she loved him, she cared about him, and she was proud of him as he began to stand down. So he surrendered peacefully, and that is why there was not another mass murder at that school on that day last August. I cite this impressive story not to say that this would always work. Sometimes someone's mind is so agitated they can't hear anything. But as an example of what can happen when a very agitated mind encounters someone speaking from the heart, it was a pretty miraculous outcome. But this incident can also be seen metaphorically as a small slice of the agitation and aggression that has poisoned our political process all across the country, in the state capitals as well as Washington. People just talking at each other with great aggression and nobody really listening to what's driving these feelings. So having the skills to hear someone, to be present to someone, and to live in love has everything to do with the healing of our public life that is so badly needed. And in this big area, well, it's another one in which Marianne Williamson has excelled for decades, teaching these life skills, these spiritual skills. And she has a new book out, as I say, A Year of Miracles, Daily Devotions and Reflections. So, Marianne, what was your goal in writing this book?
Well, it's interesting. I knew I was going to be running for office this year, and I feel that the more deeply you root yourself in your own internal spirit, reflection, mindfulness, whatever words we want to use right now, because they seem to have, like, every year, every season, there's a new trend for what you call it.
That's right.
The more deeply we ground ourselves in our inner life, then the more powerful and effective we can be in our outer lives. Mm-hmm. And I knew if you're going to do something like a political campaign, you want to make sure that every morning you get yourself really centered inside, so that when you encounter the chaos and the craziness of the world, you are not as affected by it. You are not assaulted by modernity in the way we usually are these days. And so that you yourself can help become a transformer of that of that cacophony and that chaos. You know, mm-hmm. when you told the story you just told, that was a religious woman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that takes a lot of spiritual practice
mm-hmm.
to be where she was that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you read the story of Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks didn't just one day decide to say, I'm tired.
That's right.
This was a continuation of the kind of activism that she had been involved with for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so Antoinette, well, I don't remember her last name.
Tuff, T-U-F-F.
She didn't just all of a sudden have the power to remain that peaceful in the midst of all that chaos and that loving in the midst of all that fear. That was a musculature. That was a spiritual musculature that she had.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't just come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for all of us, there's something here about how some real chaotic situations are coming down,
mm-hmm.
hopefully in our lives, nothing near as chaotic as what she confronted with the man, you know, about to shoot everybody up with an assault weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But still, most of us cower in fear and
mm-hmm.
reactiveness
mm-hmm.
regarding the chaos of our times.
And that's interesting, because she had a lot of internal fear, but she kept remembering things her pastor had said, and she kept praying and said, give me the strength to do that. And she manifested the strength to remain calm and do it.
Well, absolutely, because she knew that that strength does not come from her mortal mind.
Mm.
And that's really when you ask me, why did I write the book? I wrote the book in order that I and anybody else who reads it might remain centered in their internal calm and their internal peace, praying as you were just saying, for the help to do that, because there is a level of divine intercession from a thought system beyond our own. The mind is so much bigger than just the mortal mind. We mm-hmm. we have so much more dimension of thought and consciousness than the mortal mind alone can tap into.
Mm-hmm.
And through meditation and prayer, we expand our access, we expand our contact with aspects of the mind that otherwise are not operative. And that's what happened in that situation with her. Yes, mm-hmm. her mortal self felt the fear, but mm-hmm. it was what prevailed there was not mm-hmm. her fear and the reactive fear-based behavior that it would have led to, which would probably have just really just ignited the whole situation,
mm-hmm.
but instead other aspects of her mind that were aligned with her heart and with her own spiritual source prevailed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what we're talking about here. Which part of you, which part of an aspect of selfhood are you going to play in any given moment? It's
mm-hmm.
like we all decide, you know, what are you bringing down? What file are you bringing down?
Mm-hmm.
What note are you choosing to play?
So mm-hmm.
I totally agree with you. What a magnificent example she was for all of us of
mm-hmm.
what can happen when someone is so grounded in love that they can transform even the deepest fear. And that's what the miracle is.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
was a miracle. That was an absolute miracle.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. Well, we're actually just about out of time here, but I want to tell people that this is a very skillful and beautiful book that will
Thank
align you,
you
with the entire universe. And I had picked out some reflections here. There's one on embracing what's important. That's very important. Go through the day. There's so much that's trivial and not important for us to be focusing on. On the key to happiness is another reflection piece. On reclaiming our power. On meeting limits with unlimited thought. And also this lovely reflection, may I see all the beauty around me today. So that's all the time we have, Marianne Williamson, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the program.
Well, I thank you so much, Shirley, and I'm your biggest fan. I enjoy listening to you. I agree with the things that you say, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak into the listening of your audience and having an opportunity to tell about my own congressional campaign so that people will have the opportunity to go to MarianneForCongress.com and, you know, participate and support in any way they feel moved to so that we can have more and more candidacies around the country that are actually basing our platforms on the issues you discuss.
Yeah, great. Okay.
Thank you so much, darling.
Well, let's walk over to the Arts Corner and see what we have there. Now, I usually read a poem and play a song in the Arts Corner at the end of every program. But in this New Year's program, I'm going to do something different. To start the new year, I'm going to play a 13.5-minute, it's actually a little shorter than that even. It's an audio tape that presents the overarching theme of this program, which is that we, our body, minds, and everything around us are far, far more dynamically interrelated than anyone thought, and that we are now finally living through what I call the relational shift as more and more of the recent discoveries are made about unexpected interrelatedness. So this tape was sent to me a few days ago. It's the audio recording of a TEDx talk I was invited to give in mid-November. The visual tape got very washed out for some reason, but the audio tape turned out fine, and I want to play it for you because it presents the framework into which the array of guests will fit that I'll be having on this year. Here it is.
You may recall, if you're old enough, that there were several best-selling books in the 1970s, 1980s, and 90s, and they were about discoveries that had been made in physics, and then in chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And the gist of these discoveries was that the physical world is a lot more interrelated than our modern schooling had supposed. And that's because our schooling and all our systems of knowledge were based on the mechanistic worldview, which holds that a person or an entity is essentially separate and discrete. Two entities, whether they're people or raccoons or pine trees, they can be in some sort of relationship or not. But that doesn't change their internal constitution and the way they function in the world. So that's the mechanistic perspective. The relational perspective is that every entity is surrounded by dynamic interrelationships, and those definitely do affect your inner organ systems and the way you function in the world. Those interrelationships are dynamic because they're in flux. They change in response to subtle perturbations. They're creative, they're unpredictable, they're full of possibilities. And that's the relational perspective. So looking back, I think now that maybe those discoveries were too abstract for most people to pay much attention to. And in any event, you could look around and see that our institutions did not change in order to match these new discoveries. I was among the writers who back then were saying, gee, shouldn't we be getting in sync with this more realistic understanding of physical reality? But that didn't happen. And I think the only area in which the relational worldview got a toehold really was what was called then alternative medicine, complementary medicine, integral medicine, which eventually and grudgingly was given a small place in the mainstream medical system. But I was waiting for the big transformation across the board. It didn't happen. We were into the 2000s then. I was still waiting. In 2007, I was reading the morning paper, and I saw a small article. And this was about a study that had been done on the physical condition of a certain population. And the journalist noted in the study that the researchers had been surprised by the findings. And I was surprised by the findings. But I could see instantly that they were a result of dynamic interrelatedness. So I cut out the article, and I looked up the study online. That was interesting. And I filed it away. And then a few weeks later, I saw another article about a similar surprising discovery that the researchers had not expected in the findings. And then I saw another one, and then another one. So I cut out all these articles, looked up the full study online. After a few years, I had a big pile. And I drew those together in a book in 2011 called Relational Reality. And these are some of those findings. There was a study done of 906 elderly adults. And it was found that those who had the fewer friends or social contacts had a more rapid decline in motor function, including standing, gripping, and balancing. And it was also found in a Swedish study that having a few good friends is a very strong protective factor against elderly people in terms of who's going to develop dementia. The Swedish researchers will tell you it's much more important than sitting in a room alone doing crossword puzzles. So in a different study, people of all ages who were given a test of mental facility and memory, if they talked to someone first for 10 minutes, either in person or even on the phone, they did better on that test. And it was found that the more social contacts you have, the higher your level of mental functioning. So relationships make us smart, and they keep us smart. But how did we get smart in the first place? The mechanistic perspective is that when you're born, you have a fixed level of intelligence, and that's that. But that's not so. A number of discoveries in recent years have identified relational factors in the family that have a strong effect on the development and the expression of intelligence. And one of those is breastfeeding. It's been found that if you were fortunate enough to be exclusively breastfed for the first year of your life, that added 4 points to your IQ score. That's been found in a number of tests. Most recently, a study that was published just 3 months ago by the Journal of the American Medical Association, their pediatric branch. But it's not just the neurosugars in the breast milk. It's also the hours of intimate relationship between the mother and the nursing child, when all kinds of relational information is exchanged by the eye and the voice, touch, other body language, and all that stimulates brain development. And then in a different area, our immune system. The biomechanistic system could never explain why some people catch cold a lot more than others, even if they get enough exercise, enough rest, eat well, take vitamin C. And a study was done at a university where they asked the volunteers to fill out a survey. How many friends and social contacts do you have? How often do you socialize with them? And then they sprayed into the nose of each volunteer a cold virus. And they subsequently found that the people who had said they have a lot of friends were 4 times less likely to develop a cold after receiving the virus. So these are all examples of beneficial results from good relationships, but bad relationships have a physical effect on us as well. And last year there was a study of children and violence. It was found that if children under 10 are exposed to violence, whether being directly physically assaulted and injured, or even just witnessing violence, they then undergo a change in their cells. Their telomeres shorten. That's the part of the cell. It's like a little cap that protects the DNA material during cell division. And the shortening of the telomeres is usually what's seen in aging. And it was also found that the more types of violence the child had been exposed to, the faster the rate of the erosion of the telomeres, shortening their lifespan and compromising their health throughout adulthood. So we are profoundly relational beings with all that entails. But we're not only in relationship with other people. We also have inherent interrelationships with the rest of the natural world. And you may have heard that people who work in daylighted buildings get sick less often. They have a lower absentee rate than people whose workplace has very little natural light. And if you've been in a hospital recently, the odds are good that you've noticed their decor has changed and they've brought in nature motifs. You may have seen leaf patterns on the drapery. And sometimes there's a photograph of a big mountain scene directly across from every patient's bed on the wall. Why are they doing this? It's because there's so much evidence that sparking us, reminding us of that interrelationship we have with nature, even through an image, helps our healing process. And then, since we're talking about nature, other species, we should stop a moment here and think about the many species of bacteria that live in us, for the most part, helping our organ systems do what they need to do. You may have seen in the media articles that the field of microbiology has undergone a sea change in the last 2 years, because they always operated on the mechanistic perspective. So they said, if you have a bad bacteria in your intestinal tract or really anywhere in your body, there's nothing to do except go in and kill it with a broad-spectrum antibiotic, which had the unfortunate effect of killing your whole microbiota. But what they discovered a few years ago is that the bacteria operate in relationship, and that what was making people ill with Crohn's disease, asthma, allergies, other chronic conditions, was not so much the presence of the bad bacteria, but the lack of the good bacteria that suppresses the effect of the bad one. So the new therapy is to implant the missing good bacteria, and that takes care of the problem. So all these examples are what I call relational physiology, that our physical condition is affected by our relationships. But relational physiology is only one area in which the relational shift is transforming our systems and institutions. It's really moving through so many: education, parenting, in the business world, urban design. But even all those which are focused on the human are not what the essential discovery is about with the relational shift. It's really about our awakening to the fact that the entire physical world, the entire universe, is constituted and operates through dynamic interrelationships, and that we humans are a part of that. We're nestled in this endless field of interrelationships that make us what we are. It's so cozy. And moreover, there is a level of pathos in the fact that it's 2013 and we're just now making these very basic discoveries about our own nature. But on the other hand, it's so terrific that the relational shift is rippling through all these fields now. So these discoveries that are driving this transformation, which are very concrete, they're very accessible, they're going to keep coming. And I hope the next time you read about one or hear about one, you'll think to yourself, oh yes, that's another example of the relational shift. In the end, the most important implication for us to take to heart is that the quality of our knowing in any situation depends on the quality of our awareness of the dynamic interrelationships. Nothing exists outside of interrelationship. That's how we're structured, that's how we function, and that is how the world really works. Thank you.
Woo! So, now you know all about relational reality and the relational shift. Those few examples are just from the hundreds that are in the book Relational Reality, but that gives you an idea of what's going on now. It's very big. Okay, in case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on January 16th with my guest, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink and author of the book Drone Wars. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that we know.